Welcome to Sparks of History, where Jewish history and world history meet. We are very honored and pleased to have with us today Rabbi Pinchas Winston. Rabbi Winston is a noted and acclaimed author, lecturer, and educator. Rabbi Winston attended Yeshivat Eish HaTorah in the Old City of Jerusalem, where he received his rabbinic ordination smicha from Rabbis Avraham Kufshitz and Rabbi Noach Weinberg. Rabbi Winston hosts the Ask the Rabbi radio show for Arutz Sheva, which is the Israeli national radio station. Rabbi Winston has authored scores and scores of books. I'm not sure what the count is. Different sites have it at 50, at 100. So suffice to say that those books include, among all the many ones, The Unbroken Chain of Jewish Tradition, The Eternal Link, Life's a Thrill, No Atheist in a Foxhole, Changes That Last Forever, A Great Jewish Leader, Redemption to Redemption, Anticipating Redemption, The Physics of Kabbalah, All About Energy, Reincarnation. We could probably have a podcast for each and every one of the books. But today we were discussing Rabbi Winston's fascinating work, The Mystery of Jewish History. Rabbi Winston, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
To get started, what inspired you, Rabbi Winston, to write The Mystery of Jewish History? What message do you hope readers will take from it? And why do you call it The Mystery of Jewish History? What makes it mysterious?
Well, and the truth is, the name of your program really is the answer to all those questions. I don't know if you realize it, but calling it the Sparks of History really is extremely accurate, because Jewish history and the way we keep track of it is very different in actuality than we're used to, the way the world does in general. And I mean from a more Kabbalistic perspective. And what happened was basically, in the process of my writing, the process of my personal learning, I began to, deeper and deeper, first Midrashim, and then eventually into Kabbalah. And it's absolutely astounding how many principles there are about the basis of history that, once you learn them and you look back, you can't understand how you ever thought you understood what was going on in the first place. For example, a classic case in point, which actually is very relevant to last week's parsha, is the story of Iyov, or Job, right? The book of Job. And that's always been held up as the classic example of why bad things happen to good people, because the story seems to portray a very righteous individual who, God has a bet with the Sitra Achra, the Satan, whatever you want to call him, about his righteousness, and he's made to suffer seemingly just for the sake of a bet. And that doesn't make sense. And that has been used over and over again throughout history as an example of either how God is not involved in history, because he would never let that happen if he was, or that he is and he's cruel and he's mean. He lets, things. And even Moshe Rabbeinu himself, right? I don't know, do I have to translate all these names into English as well?
Moses.
Moses, yes. Even the great Moses Rabbeinu himself, teacher Moses, that he himself, the Gemara says that he asked God the same question, but he asked it differently. He didn't just ask, why did bad things happen to good people? He also asked, why do good things happen to good people? And he also asked, why do good things happen to bad people? And why do bad things happen to bad people? We only asked one quarter of those questions, and he asked all four, because he knew history. He understood that none of it makes sense unless you take the time to go deep into the principles of how God created this world and runs this world. And as you start to become exposed to that, and I mean through the Zohar, would be, the main one of the main works is Idra Rab, Idra Zuta, and Sifra Desnu. So these are all very obscure works for the average person, even who's familiar with the Zohar to some degree. But in there, they establish the principles upon which creation was built. And as I began to learn these and kind of decipher history a lot more accurately than in the past, I just felt the need to share that with other people. I mean, I get asked these questions a lot, especially since October 7th and what's happened since then. And now history seems to be going backwards once again. We're giving back things that we fought for and we gave up lives for, and why are we doing this, and why is God allowing it, and of course the Holocaust is one of the biggest question marks on all of history, and all these things that have really pushed people to the limit in terms of their trust in God, their faith in God. And the truth is, as you start to go into Kabbalah, most of these questions disappear. So, the book was written to try to share some of those insights, some of those deeper insights into the mechanics of Jewish history, so that the people will be better equipped to be able to deal with those questions and realize that the story of Eel, for example, is not about why bad things happen to good people, but rather there was divine justice taking place. So you have to explain why the story was written that way as opposed to another way. But in a sense, Torah, the Torah world rewards the curious who's willing to take the time to find out why things are the way they are. You'll hit a wall at some point anyhow, right? You can't understand the infinite mind of God. No one expects to, but we can understand a lot more than we think we can. And the Torah says that we're not going to just spill our guts, so to speak, to the whole world. But if you're interested to find out, come take a look, and learn, and then become stronger because of it. So I just felt that if I merited to be exposed to this information myself, I have an obligation to share it with people who don't necessarily, have that opportunity as well. So that's basically, where the book came from, and call you the mystery because that's the way people approach it. For the most, like this is just to make the point more clearly, that's what Job's complaint was. That's what he was living his slice of time in his own personal life, and all of this, everything was going fine. As long as things were happening the way he thought they should logically, based upon how he was living his life, and he was righteous, and relatively speaking, it all makes sense. But the moment things went south, right, the moment everything started to blow up in his face, and he couldn't understand why, so then he began to realize there's a lot more going on. I don't understand. So he turned to God, and God said to him, classic, classic answer. How can you possibly understand what's going on today if you don't understand all of history? Your life, you're just a one link in the chain. Your life is impacted by what came before you, and your life is even impacted by what's going to come after you in the end. So, until now, you never took the time to check that out because you never really had to, or you thought you never had to. Right, but had you done that, this would not be a question for you. This is why the Gemara says that Ezehu Chacham, right? Who is a Chacham? Haroi is a Noilid, somebody who sees what's going to be born, which means that he's going to take the time to figure out in advance what's going on, so that when history does, start to go strange and detour and all that, then he'll be prepared for that.
Okay. I mentioned you talk in the beginning, right in the beginning of the book, about this concept of self-honesty.
Right.
What is that? Why is that important? How does that connect to history?
Well, a lot of the, look at World War II, for example. Chamberlain came back. He met with Hitler, in Munich. And he's waving a paper saying, peace in our time, peace in our time. And Churchill's going, what, are you crazy? No way. The man's taking over Europe. He's you cannot satisfy him in any way. And we don't prepare for, so where does that come from? How is it possible that they can make such a catastrophic mistake? World War One, they shot Duke Ferdinand in the Balkans. Who thought that would lead to a world war in the end? And one of the main reasons why is that the information, the signs of where history is going are often right in front of us. We can see what's happening. It's like the person who gets sick. You start to feel, your eyes start to water, your nose starts to run a bit. And there are people who say, oh, I'm getting sick, and right away start to take care of themselves. Other people deny it. They go into what's cognitive dissonance. They want to pretend they're not going to get sick, like it's a somehow just a malfunction in the body. And of course, they get sicker and they get everyone sick around them as well, right? So the self-honesty is hugely important in every aspect of life because without it, you can never really grasp the truth. The bottom line is that God can't talk to you, so to speak. What's the point of sharing, information about life? When I say talk to you, I don't mean like, you hear a voice. If you start hearing voices, it's a bigger problem, right? But through divine providence, the things that happen to us, he's always communicating on some level through the events of history and the things that people say to us and the things that occurred to us. These are ways that God communicates with us. But it takes an honest person, someone who's willing to face the truth, to be able to recognize what's happening, to know how to respond to it. And here we are once again. The whole world, has been doing this for thousands and thousands of years, unable to confront certain truths about life, which always ends up backfiring and causing bigger problems.
Divine providence. Why is divine providence such a major force in Jewish history and world history? And how do we see this playing out in major historical events? How do we see those signs of divine providence?
Well, if you think about it, really, there really is no other way but to include it and to incorporate it because this is God's world. Contrary, people mistake God's patience for his absence. The fact that he puts up with so much and doesn't respond right away, it could take months, it could take years, it could take decades, even a century before God responds to something, and people say, "Well, you see, he's not here; doesn't exist." But otherwise, he clearly would have responded to that, but he doesn't. But everything, by definition, is divinely orchestrated. That's like saying, if you think about it, you go to see this fantastic symphony, which has 80 different players, musicians all across the stage, and someone turns and says, "What do we need the maestro for? What do we need the conductor for? I mean, he's just blocking my view. And if he would just get off the stage and go someplace else, he's not playing the instruments. He's not the one." And the truth is, I don't even I know how it works, because they're all looking down their music sheets, right? And they're all been training and all that. But somehow he's got to be there, and he takes a big bow at the end because he is the one who is making it all come true in the end, making it all work out. So this is the same idea, that God is the conductor, he's the maestro, he's the one coordinating all of history towards an ultimate end. And I know it looks sloppy sometimes. It looks like, if he's conducting, how did this happen? How could evil, be able to do so much, accomplish so much, and get away with it seemingly? The reality is that that's, again, goes back to the original answer about Kabbalah, because if one day in the future, we get to the world to come and we look back at history, finally understanding where it was going in the first place, then everything will make sense to every last detail. But it's only going to work because God himself is conducting it and leading it. And that's we call Shkacha Pratis, divine providence.
And where does that, and this is obviously a question that's been asked by many in many different scenarios, divine providence and free will, which you write about. So it's a basic tenet of Judaism, free will, absolute free will. How do you connect free will with divine providence? Is there an issue? Is there not an issue? And how does that play out in history?
Well, one of the things, and I've given a lot of thought to this over the years, and it's been a big discussion in a lot of classes, and I've read a lot of things on it. The starting point is that we definitely have free will because the Torah tells us that. That alone, is important to know. We're rewarded for the good things we do. We're going to be punished for the bad things we do, and that, you can't do that if there's no system of free will that we're living by. So that's the starting point. And so much about life and history, and we seem to throw the term around a lot anyhow, accept it. He willed to win, he willed to accomplish this thing, and we take free will very seriously. The problem is that we don't quite understand how God can be above time and know the outcome of the event, and not just that, but set it up, and somehow we have free will. So, if you think about it, it's not much different than an example. Let's say you have a 3-year-old in front of you, and he doesn't know, but that he's right-handed. And he'll always reach for something with his right hand because he's right-handed. And he'll always reach for the closest thing to his right hand as well. So you say, watch, I know which hand he will pick. And you put the candy in your left hand because it's closest to his right hand. And you put your hands up and your left hand just slightly ahead of the right hand. So you're actually controlling the whole moment. But he doesn't know that. He's making a choice. The truth is his choice is very much influenced by what you're doing, but doesn't change the fact that he's making a choice in the end. He, as far as he's concerned, he's looking, thinking, yeah, we don't have absolute free will. That's important to know. In other words, we can't make a decision independent of God's will. That would be absolute free will. You can't do that. Because anyhow, we exist inside of God. So it's really impossible to have that such a scenario anyhow. But for us to have absolute free will would make us God like himself. Of course, it's not possible. So the question is, how much free will do we actually have? Free will we have. How much do we have? Remains to be seen. And the truth is that the biggest mistake that I think we tend to make, and I see this happen all over the place all the time, that we think that we're so smart, that we're so intelligent and so well learned to be able to make a decision, talk about a topic as if we know there's everything that we need to know about it. Meaning that I can ask the question, how do we have free will if God is, God is absolute will and he's involved in every decision I make and all that. But that's assuming that I understand the dynamics of history to such a degree that I can ask that question. But one thing about learning Kabbalah, you go, I know so much more than I did 5, 10 years ago, and yet I feel like I know less. It feels like I know less. You can ask me questions that I can answer that I could not answer 10 years ago. But overall, it feels like, in a sense, it's like, the James Webb telescope, right? That one that goes out to outer space and is showing us images of the edges of the universe that we never thought we'd ever see in our lifetime. And all that's happened is it's shown us the universe so much more vast than we've been able to see up until now through the Hubble telescope and from Earth and all that. But seeing the universe even more in a larger scale hasn't made us say, oh, now we understand what's going on. It's more like, whoa, we thought that we were looking at a big world before. Now the world's really big, much bigger than we could even comprehend. So, but somehow by knowing more, we ended up knowing less. So the starting point of answering that question is we really can't answer the question. All we know, the givens, are that God says we have free will. And if a person, and the Nefesh HaChayim, by the way, talks about this in the third shahr of his landmark work. And the person could argue the point and say, how can we have free will if God he knows everything he does, he plans everything. You can ask that question, but the bottom line is on your day of judgment, they're going to say to you, for this thing you did right, you chose well, this is what you get. For the bad thing, but we didn't have free will. And God's going to say, that's what you said. I didn't say that. I told you you did. Best to go with the approach that we have free will to use it to the best of our ability. And those questions will get answered later on, God willing.
The commentators, the sages, connect the biblical encounter between Joseph and his brothers to the brutal deaths of the 10 martyrs that happened many, many years after the incident between Joseph and his brothers. Why is the biblical encounter of Joseph and his brothers so significant? And what does the connection of that to the 10 martyrs on the hands of the Romans tell us about Jewish and world history?
Yeah, it's a very profound question. I mean, we do see that connection in the Musaf of Yom Kippur. We also bring it up in the Kinos of Tisha B'Av as well. Obviously, it's a very central point. But one of the most important parts of the story of Yosef and his brothers really actually is summed up by King David in Tehillim, which he wrote about himself. But really, it's a kind of a pattern of history. And he wrote the words Evan Maso Boinim Haisa La Rosh Pina. The stone that the builders rejected is the cornerstone, meaning that his brothers, his father, the community, the society rejected David. They rejected him. They thought he was a nobody. They thought he was actually born from an illicit relationship, and that really he had no place in Jewish history. And it ended up being exactly the opposite, like so opposite. The story, goes that God told Shmuel the prophet, Samuel, right, to go to anoint the king of the Jewish people, the next king of the Jewish people after King Saul, and it would come from the family of Yishai, and they had them all lined up in a big banquet. To is a very historic moment. So they had them all lined up, seven sons, and they're all strong and and good soldiers and fear of God and really perfect specimens. He did a great job raising his kids. And in the end, Shmuel shows up with the anointing oil and it rejects everybody. So he turns to Yishai, he says, anybody else left? Because apparently nobody here fits the bill. And he says, David, he's out there, killing lions and shepherding animals and all that, but you don't want him. Shmuel says, it's not me. So they bring him in and he sees him. And even he, at first glance, this great prophet who's compared to Moses himself, right? Doesn't really see in David any signs of the leadership of the Jewish people and the ancestry of Mashiach. Doesn't see it. The anointing oil jumps out of the horn that it's in to anoint. It can't wait for King David's approach, right, to go anoint him. It jumps out of the, a miracle, right? And then, of course, everyone is absolutely blown away and it turns everything on its head. And he, of course, becomes the king of the Jewish people. But even to the end of his life, he was still suffering and lots of. What does it tell you? What do you learn from all this? That you can't approach Jewish history as straightforward. It's an amazing thing how today we're so critical and we approach things as if everything's black and white. There's nothing black and white about Jewish history, just the clothing that we wear, right? There's nothing really straightforward about Jewish history. On the contrary, Jewish history is so incredibly convoluted. I mean, we go ahead like other religions, right? They can't deal with certain issues, so they come up with things like Immaculate Conception, right? And we go ahead and we have King David born from a potentially seemingly wrong relationship, and he has to he's called a mumser all of his early years, and he has to fight against all the and this is and Moshe too. Right, Moses grows up in the house of the of Pharaoh, and his daughter is like Jewish history is so convoluted, and the story is telling us, and it carries all the way through to the martyrs too, because the whole story doesn't make sense, right? The story, according to the Medrash, according to the Musaf that we read, the Caesar said he fills a room full of shoes. And brings in 10 of the greatest rabbis of that time. Not even actually at the exact same moment according to history, but 10 of the greatest rabbis. And he says, what is the halacha? Caesar's a religious guy now. All of a sudden he's quoting Torah and he's got, when was the last time a Caesar required a halachic reason to kill a Jew, a great rabbi? They just do it, right? But he says he fills a room full of shoes because they sold Yosef for shoes. The Medrash says, right? So he's like hinting to what's going on. And he says, what's the law if you kidnap a fellow Jew and you sell him? What's the law? And they consult, they knew the halacha, and they said, it's actually part of the Ten Commandments, this week's Parsha. the halacha is that you kill the people who did it. They're chayiv misa, they get capital punishment for it. And they answer this back. And he comes back and he says, you're right. I know that, and you know that. And there's been nobody as great as them. Since them as you, so you're gonna stand in their position and make amends for their deaths, for what they did, what they should have been killed. Well, they should have been killed, they would have been killed, but they weren't, right? So there's no halacha that they had to be killed in their place, and besides, they didn't do it. But in Shari HaGilgulim, right? Which is literally Gate of Reincarnations. That's the Arizal's classic work. There's Seder Gilgulim and Shaar HaGilgulim, basically the same material, and they discuss reincarnation. With insights into who reincarnated to who, and also personal rectification and things like that. And he explains how the 10 martyrs actually reincarnated into the, sorry, the 10 brothers reincarnated into the 10 martyrs. So they were inside these martyrs when they died. So we know that al pi halakha, according to Jewish law, there are some things a person is punishable with death, but not by the Beis Din. The Beis Din doesn't is not required or empowered to carry out certain death penalties. Heaven takes care of those ones, right? And in this case, apparently that was what was going on. So there was loose ends from the sale of Yosef forgave his brothers, but something started back then. In fact, I don't know how much time I have to go into this. It's a very big parsha, so to speak. But when Yosef, when the it's a big parsha, but the main idea is that they were supposed to recognize something. Yosef, they sold Yosef because, just like King David said, Evan Masa Boinim Haislosh Pinam. They thought that Yosef was the wrong guy for the job, that he was going to cause more problems than he was going to solve, so they got rid of him. They had no idea, even though God was giving them hints through his dreams, that he was going to lead the nation. So they took it upon themselves without consulting with their father, and they sold him and got rid of him in the end. Of course, we had that story. Then Yosef spends all this time trying to hint to that it was him. When they came down to Egypt looking for food, he was giving hints. Even the word meraglim, which is spies, right? He uses them being spies. According to one sefer, actually, each of the letters of the Hebrew word meraglim, mem, resh, gimel, lamed, yud, mem, alludes to a different word. Me'imi Rachel ganavtem, me'midyanim yishmalim mechartem. From my mother Rachel, you stole me, to yishmalim, to Arabs, and to the midyanim, people from Midyan, you sold me. He's hinting all over the place. My Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Noach Weinberg Zitzel, once told me, actually, he was at the bris of my son, that he said that what was supposed to happen, Yosef said, Ani Yosef, only because he realized they weren't getting the message and they were going to go to war against Egypt and probably die in the process. So therefore, he was forced to reveal himself, but he was trying to get them to say, Atai Yosef. Why was that so important? Because if they had come to that realization that it was Yosef before them, they would have realized the detail to which God, how much he was involved in every last aspect of history. We have a concept in Judaism. Well, the truth is, we say it every day in davening, the end of Aleinu. On that day, God will be king over the entire world. God will be one, and his name will be one. Right? That's what we say every single. That's the goal of all history, that oneness. That oneness of God, where everybody wakes up and looks and says, oh, look at that. God made the world. He runs the world. He's everyone's God, not just the Jewish people's God. And he's real, and his Torah is real, right? And we are here to have a relationship with him. That's the goal of all human history. Now, look how far we are from that. So Yosef, with that whole story of Yosef and his brothers, they were the first ones to try to implement this, to get this going. By disregarding, talk about self-honesty, but by disregarding Yosef's dreams and then selling him, they were denying the Hashgacha Pratis, the divine providence, and what was going on, because the dreams were from God. They were from God. They sold him, right? Down. So that's why later on, the Gemara says, when Yaakov, which is Jacob, he wanted, just before he died, he wanted to reveal the end of days to his sons. The Torah itself says so. Not even a Medrash. The Torah itself, but he moves on. He doesn't, so the Gemara says that there was a dialogue. He came to reveal the end of days, what was going to happen, how history was going to unfold, the bottom line to all that we're going through, all the way to the end. But the prophecy left him. So he was worried. Maybe somebody wasn't right here. So he says to his sons, he says, okay, why have I lost this prophecy? Did somebody not do tshuva? For what? For what? Does someone not do tshuva here? Otherwise, why would God take this prophecy in the days away from me? So you know what they answer back? You know how the brothers answer their father when they ask that question? Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. What kind of answer is that? What, you say to your son, right? Did you fix up that mistake you made? Abba, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu. I didn't ask you if you're religious. I didn't ask you daven Mariv tonight. I don't know. Did you fix up? Did you tshuva? No, that's my answer. Shema Yisrael, Hashem. So they say to Yaakov Avinu, they say, just like God is one in your heart, He's one in our heart too as well. So you see, the whole issue the entire time is the oneness of God. But Yaakov comes back, the Gemara says, and says, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuson Ve'ed, which only is 24 letters, unlike the Shema, which is 25 letters. And Yaakov's answer, according to the Zohar now, because the Gemara doesn't explain it beyond that, but the Zohar explains that Yaakov wanted to give it 25 letters like the Shema, and that would have meant, okay, good, everything's good. We're all good here, right? But he didn't, because he said, if that was the case, I wouldn't have lost the prophecy. Something is not right still here. And the answer comes out later on after Yaakov dies. Because at the end of Parshas Vayechi, right, they come to Yosef and they say to Yosef, because Yosef used to have them all over for supper. These are big family meals when their father was alive. And he got too busy and stopped inviting them, which goes to show you how to be very careful how you treat your family, and how things can be misconstrued, especially if people feel guilty for things they've done. But they think that maybe he's going to kill them now. Now that Yaakov's gone, what's going to hold them back? He's the viceroy of Egypt. So they tell Menashe, which is Yosef's son, to tell their father that Yaakov told them to tell him before he died not to harm them. And Yosef comes back and says, Tachas Elokim Anochi. Right? Did you learn nothing from all of this? You try to kill me. Were you successful? No. Why not? Because God didn't let you. He didn't want you to. If I want to kill you and God doesn't want you to die, I can't kill you. If I want to save you and God doesn't want to save you, I can't save you. But it's all God in the end. Didn't you learn anything from all this? So it says that Yosef cries and they cry too. They're all crying together, and it seems like a nice emotional moment where they all realize we should have trusted our brother more, and he feels bad they didn't, mistrust them. But that's not why Yosef is crying. He's crying because he's saying that rectification of the unification of God, right? He didn't get it. And now, because of that, we're going to go through a lot of exile, a lot of suffering just to fix all that up. We're going to have to go through in Egypt. We're going to have to go through, after Egypt and the four exiles of our prophecy in the end. So the Rizal explains in Shar Psukim Shar Gagulim that when the 10 martyrs died the way they did, they were fixing up for all of that. Because if you notice, one of the star role, the star players in the entire episode, of course, is Rabbi Akiva. How does he die? Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu. Even his own Talmidim go, Rebbe, at this moment, you can do that? You can have such kavana? I have a difficult time having kavana sitting in my comfortable Beis Medrash with no one breathing down my neck and no one coming after me. And I got to focus on these six words and 25 letters without letting my mind go someplace else. And not think about, dinner or breakfast or whatever the case may be, right? And he's like being raked with combs, and he's saying the Shema with more kavana than most people in the entire life, but he's saying the Shema. No, he's purposely doing that because that's the whole point. He's saying, and he's telling his Talmidim, are you kidding? This is the whole moment that life comes down to. Look at the message. And this comes up, by the way, another martyr, Rabbi Chanina Taradjian. Right, the famous story of him, he's teaching Torah in public. They capture him, they wrap him up in the Sefer Torah, they put wet wool on him so he'll die slowly. And he's having a dialogue first with his daughter and then with his students also. And they're saying, and his daughter says, to see you die like this is a terrible thing. And he says, don't worry about it because the same God who avenged the disgrace of the Torah that's wrapped around me will also avenge me as well. And his students, are saying, Rebbe, what do you see? And he says, oh, I see parchment burning, but letters floating up to Shemai. My body will die, but my soul will go on forever, which is not the case with these Romans. The most amazing thing, I love these stories. These stories in the Gemara, they're just so, Yeah, I gotta stop and think about them. There's this Roman executioner watching this whole thing take place. He's the guy responsible for killing him. And he's watching this dialogue play take place, and he's going, either these people are crazy. Mom is like, who has it? Who is a, everybody else I've killed over here is usually screaming for mercy. And they're panicking and they're going out the most non-dignified way possible. And he's having this conversation like he's in the Beis Medrash. So either they're crazy or they really believe. And if what they really believe is true, then I'm in big trouble. Do you know what he does? He converts. A Roman executioner is like the lowest of the low in the totem pole. It's like this is like, you don't get much lower than this, but the Kiddush Hashem, the sanctification of God's name is so incredibly intense that it moves this Roman executioner to convert to Judaism and then jump into the fire and die as part of the process. And he goes to the world to come, the Gemara says. What do we learn from all of this? This is not, these are not side stories. Like we live today, I do my thing, you do your thing, he's doing his thing, you're doing everything. We're all over the place living our slices of time. We have jobs, we have families and all that. And we're just surviving from day to day, but we lose track of the main theme of history. And that's it right there. That story's in the Gemara, not to tell us about what once happened, but to tell us about what history is all about and will be happening until history ends. That's why history ends with the final, if it happens to come, play out that way. But all the prophets talk about the war of Gog and Magog, the famous war of God. Even the Christians, Armageddon. It's everywhere. Everyone's got their, everyone's got their own version of it, right? But most people don't realize is the whole point of the war of Gog and Magog is just to reintroduce God to the world. Everyone will finally wake up and realize, oh yeah, look at that. He's real after all.
You talk every once in a while about rectification, and of course, there's this concept that's thrown around and used in so many different ways, tikkun olam, rectifying the world, fixing that which is broken. What is the true understanding from the Torah sources of tikkun olam, and how is that connected to what you call the tohu of history?
Right.
The And I'm not sure how you would translate tohu in this context.
They usually translate it as chaos, null and void. But as a simple analogy is like baking a cake. You can either go to the bakery and buy one already prepared, right? Or you can get your hands dirty and make one from scratch. Now, everybody will agree. I don't know about everybody, but a lot of people will agree that it's more fun to actually bake your own cake. A rabbi I once I know he actually once asked his students. He said, "What's better, to receive $1 billion for free, or to work for it? Either way, you end up with $1 billion, right? But which one would you prefer?" So of course everybody said for free. Wrong answer. It's not even the way we misunderstand the question and the answer itself. Why? Because everything we have in life is only enjoyable if we can experience it. If someone tells you about a vacation that they had, but you weren't there yourself personally, it's just words. You might even get a little, I might feel, oh, I wish I could do the same thing as well, because I could use a vacation like that. But they have this big smile on their face. And they're talking about it like they were just there. If you try and recall, a really wonderful experience that happened, even years ago, and you can rebuild it because it became part of you, part of the experience. When you buy something, it becomes part of you. You give up something to receive back, and you become unified. The Torah says a man shall leave his father and mother and get married and become basar echad, one flesh. But in order to be able to do that, you have to give kesef kedushin. You have to give a certain amount of money, monetary value to your wife, right? And even though it's more symbolic than anything else, but it is the idea of giving up to get. We cannot integrate anything in this world that we don't have a play a role in a part in. So the person who gets the $1 billion for free, he'll never enjoy it. That's why Asa or Esau, right? He always had to have more, because since he didn't really work for it, it never became a part of him who he was. But Yaakov said, "Yesh li kol, yesh li mispar, I have enough," because everything he had earned, he had used. It was meaningful to him. So this is just the process of life itself. It's not just economics. It's the way that we take into ourselves and become one, so that we can experience something, including God Himself. So that's why you cannot. Someone says, "If God was here, why can't I feel His presence?" Because you have to give up to get. You have to be self-sacrificing. You have to create the proper environment that God can dwell within you, and then you'll feel His presence. And any Baal Tshuva, anybody who's come back from a secular lifestyle and become religious, will tell you that that's the experience. When they first began it, they didn't feel anything. They thought that God didn't even exist. But then after time, eventually gets to a point where they start to feel like He's right there with them, because they take it into themselves. So working for the money, even though it sounds harder, enhances the experience, because it becomes you and part of you. So that's true of all of life. So therefore, as Shakespeare once said, all of life is a stage. It's much deeper than he thought, meaning that God made a perfectly imperfect world that we could use our will and our opportunities and our talents to turn that chaos into something Seder. That's why, by the way, we make a Seder once a year on Pesach. We even sing the table of contents. Why call it a Seder? Because God said, just like I turned chaos into order, I took you out of Egypt, turned the world upside down, did miracles beyond comprehension to empower you to do the same thing with the null and void of creation. That's the stage of free will. Tohu, chaos, null, void, whatever you want to call it. It's all created to give us the stage on which to act out our free will choices. And that's what Tikkun Olam is all about. Tikkun Olam is every time that we do anything to put something in its proper divine place where it belongs. And likewise, the same through and on a personal level too. Tikkun Olam for, or tikkun for a person, personal rectifications in Shahar Gilgulim, which I mentioned earlier, the book of reincarnation, the Gate of Reincarnations. Most of the book is about personal rectification, about ascending spiritually, going from one level of consciousness to a higher level of consciousness. As a person does that, they start to give the steering wheel, take it away from the body and give it to their soul. We are more godly when we're acting like our soul. And we accomplish a lot more with life, because the ultimate complement, the ultimate fulfillment in life is rising to this level, getting promoted to the level of being a partner with God in the perfection of creation. That takes care of both of Tikkun Olam, world rectification, and personal rectification all at the same time.
When we connect Joseph and his brothers to the 10 mortars, we have traditional sources that clue us in to the connection. Okay, so that's like a gift. We're given a gift of explaining the connections. So now when we take all these the mystery of Jewish history, and we take the unexpected and the chaos, how do you look at events that are more recent to us, whether it's the Shoah, the Holocaust, the founding of the State of Israel, anti-Semitism, and I don't mean to throw it all together as a, as they're equal, but how do we look at more modern events, given the clues and the Google and all the different factors that you bring out in your sefer?
It's a very good question, and the Leshem, which is really Shlomi Eliashiv, who also had a big impact on my approach, and I think quote him a lot in that sefer as well, that book as well. And he mentions how the rules haven't changed, but the opportunity has shifted somewhat. In other words, once upon a time, when we were much more spiritually powerful, more spiritually clued in, for example, the first temple. I mean, miracles took place every day in the temple. The surface that was going on inside the temple was visible. The reality of God was palpable. So how could we make so many mistakes and then lose all that? That's a discussion to itself, part of the historic process too. But it was very different. So he says that today that we don't really learn Torah, even compared to Europe 200 years ago. I was just reading on Shabbos a book about Rav Aaron Cutler, the Rosh Yeshiva of Lakewood, who survived the war and went to America. And it's like I can only read so much of these books at one time because the greatness is so overwhelmingly obvious that I can't even fathom people living like that. And that's 100 years ago. That's 50 years ago. That's not so long ago. How much more so, even longer than that? So most of what's going on historically, God's managing and taking care of it, and it's kind of being imposed on us. The choice that we have in life is for world rectification, and the fulfillment of the purpose of creation can either happen because of us or through us. That's the choice that we have. Either
Not
because of
despite
us or through.
us, not despite us.
Not despite us. Not despite us. No. Never despite us. Not evil people, maybe, but not the average person who's trying to do, be a good person, be a decent person. Maybe lazy, but decent. But through us means that we learn Torah. We understand. We take the time to understand mitzvahs. We put our heart and soul into them, and then all these rectifications take place, through us. But because of us, or actually, that's because of us. Through us. Is that we're not doing that. We're just coasting from day to day, in which case things have to happen in history, like the Holocaust, and the world learns about God because of that in the end. So I mentioned at the beginning about sparks of history. You could look at life like an upside down hourglass. A normal hourglass, all the sands of the upper chamber, and then it comes down at a certain rate into the lower chamber. When all the sand is down in the lower chamber, or salt, whatever it is, right? You have a softball day, right? Or whatever it is you're timing, right? That's how it works. History, Kabbalistically, is the opposite. All these sparks, when I say sparks, individual units of divine light, we call it Nitzotzei Kedusha, holy sparks, they're the basis of your soul, they're the basis of all energy. Scientists don't know what energy actually is. They know how to use it, they know how to apply it, what it can do, but what it is in essence, because it's a spiritual reality. It's holy sparks. It's God's light. That's the basis of all energy. The unified field theory, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, right? That's the equation. So in a sense, life and history, again, according to Kabbalah, is like a game show. A game show is you have a certain amount of time to accomplish a certain task. And they make it challenging by tying one leg behind your back or whatever, and it's very funny, and people, and sometimes they win, sometimes they lose and all that. But life is the exact same way. In other words, there's a certain amount of sparks in the world, running the world, keeping the world alive, but those sparks have to be elevated back to their source. And this gets into other discussions about things like klipot, is spiritual impurity and forces of evil. That's I think I mentioned the book itself, but that's a longer discussion. But the point is that these sparks have to be elevated. Now, how do we elevate these sparks? We're doing it now. Every time, just like, for example, when you drive your car, if you have a car, right? You drive your car, you take gasoline, and you trans, you know, the law of thermodynamics says that energy is not destroyed, it's just its form has changed. So you take that energy from your energy, from the engine, from the gasoline, and you turn it into some other source of energy. But it's energy. It gets transformed in the end, and it gets used up. And that much gasoline is no longer in the world anymore, which is why you run out of it at a certain point in time. So the same thing is true also with these sparks. These sparks are the source of life, but they have to be elevated back to their source when we eat food. It's not the nutrients that keep you alive. It's the sparks inside them. What we call nutrients are really spiritual sparks. And the reason why we call them nutrients is because we found out by trial and error that they keep us alive, they keep us healthy. But it's the sparks inside them that do that. And when we talk, we use up energy also. When I walk, I'm using up energy. Everything I do in this world requires energy. Those energy are sparks. If I use that energy in a positive way, the sparks go upwards to heaven, and we get that much, and they go to the upper chamber, so to speak, and we get that much closer to the end of history. If I use it for the wrong things, God forbid, evil things or sins and things like that, then the sparks, they eventually will go up also, but they have to be cleaned off for it first, and that may involve punishment or tshuva, whatever the case may be. But this is what history all comes down to in the end. This is the ongoing process, elevating sparks, elevating sparks. So sometimes, say a person goes out for dinner, right, and they leave their wallet at home by mistake, and they only have half the amount of money in their pocket. So what happens? Comes time for the bill, and he turns to the waiter. He's, I'm sorry, I forgot my charge card, my bill, right? He ends up washing dishes. He didn't want to wash dishes, didn't plan to wash dishes, but he has to pay for the meal, right? And the time has come, he can't stay there the whole night. I mean, these things don't happen today so much because of all the different ways to pay for things, but once upon a time, they wash dishes because there's no other way to get the money. And the same thing is true. Jewish history, especially, it has what the Gemara calls ketzim, end times. There's certain times at which redemption has to occur, or certain parts of the redemption have to occur. And the way to make them happen is by elevating a certain amount of sparks by that time. If for some reason we fall behind, we don't pay all the sparks necessary to be able to get what we need to do at that time, then God will take them from us by whatever we go through. It could be a personal experience, it could be personal difficulty, national difficulty. And, it's a difficult thing to rationalize because we don't understand the counting, so to speak. But 1948, regardless of what people will tell you, we got back the Jewish state because that was when God decided from creation the Jewish people would get back the Jewish state. That was the year. For Kabbalistic reasons, that's the year. It may seem because of Truman, it may seem because of the UN, it might seem because of the war. No, those are all just means to carry it out. But the actual decision from God, and that had to happen. But you don't get it for free. It cost, we had to pay for it to get it back. Apparently, we hadn't paid enough, and we're behind schedule in our payments. And 6 million souls left this world, sparks, each and every one of them a spark, was elevated. And because they suffered, one of the highest forms of elevating sparks, as the martyrs show us, right, is through suffering, through difficulty, through what we call Darin al Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying the name of God. And the sanctification that took place in the Holocaust is unbelievably, absolutely mind-boggling. And though we ourselves would never, if someone had said to you, you can have the land back, but you have to, kill off 6 million Jews and 1 million children, who would have said yes? Who would have said yes? No, forget it. We'll wait longer, wait longer. We're not going to kill 6 million Jews. Forget it. But that's not our cheshbon. That's not our accounting. And even if it doesn't make sense to us, one day it will. But this is the concept. All the, what happened October 7th, just, it does, and the very fact that there are so many questions surrounding it that don't make sense show you, Me'eis Hashem ha'isa zos, this is directly from God. This is overt divine providence. If it's wondrous in our eyes, and it was wondrous in our eyes, the whole thing didn't make sense. But that's a cost. That's a payment. We're still paying, apparently, because his hostages are still being kept, and still suffering, and will suffer for years to come. But every time the Jewish people suffer in any way, it's a means to elevate sparks that have to go up, and we didn't do on our own. It's not a punishment. It's a tikkun. There's a difference. It's a big difference.
And what signs should we be looking for regarding redemption, where we are in the process of redemption? As we're driving the car, is the fuel light going on now saying you better put some more fuel in the car, or are we, a little bit more in the lines there in the car, and
Yeah.
where are we, or do we not know at all?
Well, this is a question that gets, obviously, I get asked this a lot. I mean, this is the main question that people who are in touch with this topic always are asking. Like, is this just another bad period of Jewish history. We had the Crusades, we had the Chemenichi pogroms, we had the Holocaust, we had, the Romans. We've had lots of times that, yeah, and they could have been messianic. They certainly Bar Kokhba, back in his time, it looked, even Rabbi Akiva, for a little while, thought maybe this is possible. It was early. And the basic rule is the earlier it comes, the more that we have to do. The later it comes in history, the less we have to do. And eventually, according to our tradition, the final redemption will come so late, but it's already so late now, that God will take care of most of it. He'll take care. Like, there's not. I mean, obviously, we can expedite and do, make it better for ourselves by doing more tshuva. But we're just coming off a tshuva movement that for the end of the 1990s, early 2000, people were becoming bali tshuva left, right, and center, and all these organizations were getting money, and it was astounding. He admitted to Wall Street. There are people in Wall Street sitting in executive offices learning with rabbis. Not today. It came and it fizzled out, and not due to anything I think that we did wrong, per se. Just wasn't, that's what God wanted for that period of time. And now we'll go to the next stage of history. The next thing has to happen. It's an ongoing process. But what was the question again? Oh, yeah.
What are the
Sorry.
signs of
Signs, signs,
redemption?
yeah.
What are the
Signs.
signs of redemption, and where are we on the
Yeah,
fuel gauge of energy?
So there are certain things, because of that's why I mentioned all that before, that there were lots of times when we thought we had signs that it was in it, but one, you have to look at the things that we do know for sure are different. This is the year 5785. When Rabbi Akiva lived, it was around 4,000. It was like the 70 CE, the time of the Second Beis Hamikdash. Very, it was the beginning of the last 2,000 years of history, which we call Ikveh d'Mashiach, on the heels of Mashiach, right? So it was possible, but it was early still. And we're now, 1,785 years later. That's absolutely remarkable. History, according to the Gemara, according to Kabbalah, it's not disputed, right? At least not in, the Kabbalistic world. 6,000 years long. Now, here's an important point that a lot of people are not aware of that makes a big difference, because even though it's 5785, there's still 200 and 15 years left, according to that. So a lot can happen, and before 6,000. So this is a big difference that is brought down by the Zohar. And a person would say, well, the Zohar, we don't always know what the Zohar means and how can you take it literally, because it says lots of things and there were lots of predictions. But the Leshem, as I mentioned earlier, Rosh Leshem, he takes it seriously. He seems to, believe this is in fact true, and for very important reasons why it's true. But he, according to what the Zohar says, that the Chis HaMeisim, the resurrection of the dead, which has to happen in advance of going to the world to come, because we can't go like this, we're too physical. We have to go back to what Adam was like before the sin of the tree of knowledge, good and evil. So that's what the resurrection's all for. According to the Zohar, that lasts at least 210 years. And then that's after 40 years from Kibbutz Galus, the ingathering, the exiles, what the Torah speaks about in Parshas Nitzavim. Right? God promises that he's going to do that later on in history. So the combined together, it's 250 years. Now, think about Tichias Amesim, it's part of the Messianic era, but it's after Mashiach has already come. Because in the time of resurrection of the dead, there's no need for Mashiach anymore. The world has been perfected. We're now only in a transitional stage to the next stage of history called the world to come. So therefore, Mashiach has to come before that. Well, 250 years began in 1990, according to Reb Yitzchak, actually even 4 years earlier, in 1986. And if and that would place us in the Messianic era. And as a result of that, whatever's happening by definition falls in that category. So I actually sat down when I learned this material for the first time. No one mentioned this before. This is like. And I took a piece of paper and I mapped out a timeline. And I said, well, if this is true, I should be able to find things happening in history, current history, that support this idea. If I can't, then it must not be true. And sure enough, I began to plot everything, and it literally fell into place. You have Operation Solomon, Ethiopian Jews coming, kibbutz in gathering of the exiles, right under our noses, but no one paid attention because it's just part of current history. And then the Gulf War, right? The Gulf War was a suicide attempt by Saddam Hussein to take Kuwait. And what was he thinking? Of course, he's going to be, pushed back and eventually, captured and killed. But he did it anyhow. So most people don't realize the main significance of that war. And that was it created allies that previously didn't exist. Until that war, even though the Americans did business with the Saudis and Jordan and other countries and Egypt and all that, America was called the Great Satan. Until that war, they were still called during the war itself called the Great Satan. But because of the need to go in and attack Saddam Hussein, they had to use Saudi Arabia as a base to launch their sorties and missiles, whatever, to fight back and have a base for the army. That required compromise on the Americans' part at the cost of the Israelis. That was the turning point for AIPAC. Until that time, AIPAC, which is the Jewish lobby in the American Senate and House, basically, who almost every time they asked for something for Israel, they always got it, for the first time got no. They got no. Sharon changed after that. At one point in time, he was a hawk on behalf of Israeli communities and the land of Israel, became the one to heed the coup for emptying out the Gaza, to the Arabs, which is probably fighting this very day because of it. The billions of shekels that they thought they would save by giving it back to, giving to the Arabs, giving back, but giving to the Arabs, we spent way more than that and having to fight wars and lives in the process because of it. And that all that from 1990, which corresponds exactly to the beginning of another period of time, because according to history, that one day of creation is the basis of 1,000 years of history, and everything that happened in the 6 days can have has its counterpart in one of the millennia. So the hour that Adam ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which set all of this in motion, all this exile and history in motion, let's go back to the beginning. That's what all began. That was the 10th hour. And that corresponds precisely to 1990. And even more fascinating is that he ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, right? A tree of knowledge of good and evil. That was the whole issue. A tree of knowledge of good and evil. If I were to ask you, what is the best example of a tree of knowledge of good and evil over the last couple of thousand years, right? What example would come to your mind? The World Wide Web, which came into the world officially in 1990, exactly to the year. So this is just part of the story. I'm not even going through all the details.
All right.
I'm just going through this right now to show you that everything comes down to context. If you think history is open-ended, there's still people who believe that history will go on forever and ever. When I say history, I mean our history, right? 7,000, 8,000. So who says this has to be messianic? If you understand that history comes to close at 6,000, then all of a sudden it makes it more immediate. If you understand all these details I just mentioned and put them on a timeline, and show how it all fits together with history right before our very eyes, all of a sudden everything becomes very end of days-ish, so to speak. And then the signs become the signs. Yeah, the fact that we have the state back, we have a land again, that just the fact that more than half the Jewish population in the world is now in Israel, according to the Rambam, Maimonides, is hugely significant from a messianic point of view.
So we have these patterns, we have a blueprint, we have stages 2000, 2000, 2000, we have the 6000. But yet, if I understand correctly, just like by Joseph, just like by King David, the vehicle is going to be so unexpected. It's going to kind of like, whoa, this is how it plays out. This is the Messiah. This is the Mashiach. I mean, is that correct? Is that,
Yeah.
and why does it have to be that way?
Because that's what gives us the opportunity to, the most important part of any relationship is trust. The depth of any relationship is going to be bitachon, trust itself, right? The more you trust your spouse, the better the relationship is going to be. The more you trust your business partner, the stronger that relationship is going to be. It's no different when it comes to God, right? As much as God has revealed to us, as much as we know, as much as we think we understand. The bottom line is, God says, how much do you trust me? How much are you willing to, we have an expression, Gamzula Tova. And all that God does, he does for the good. Why do we have expressions like that? Because if it was obvious, we wouldn't say things like that. We'd know it. It's like they say, nobody ever asked the question, why me, when they win the lottery? Only when they don't. Right? You have to have trust in God. So therefore, there has to be question marks. There has to be unknowns. But more importantly, there has to be intelligence. Right? This like I mentioned before, the fact that we take history to be so straightforward that we make decisions and we criticize people and accept or reject based upon the obvious aspects that we see to our eyes, that's not Jewish history. Evan maaseh b'ayinim ha'aseh l'rosh pinah. And the whole thing is trusting in God, that he knows what he's doing, and trusting him for the process and trusting him for the results at the end. But it gives me the opportunity. When I was a kid growing up, and I used to have to take a subway from downtown to come home. So a lot of times you go in rush hour, and you couldn't grab onto anything. There was no bars available, no seats available. So you're actually standing there, and the subway would jerk. And if you weren't prepared for it, you would go flying into somebody else, usually, right? So it became a game. I would stand there, and I would leave my legs like loose, like to try to feel the vibrations of the car. I don't know how real that was, but so that if it would jerk, I would be ready and be flexible. And a lot of times it would work. I would be able to like with you know absorb the movement and not go flying. But every once in a while, you thought that you'd done that, and it happens all of a sudden, you go flying just like that. So I use that as an analogy for Jewish history, so to speak, that you have to leave your legs loose. You have to leave yourself open to all kinds of possibilities. The brothers didn't. So they rejected Yosef out of hand, and it cost them big time. It cost them in Shechem. It cost them later on with the sale of Yosef, and they had to give all the power back to Yaakov in the end, and all the acts of the fall as well. King David's time as well, all over again, all over again.
Just in conclusion, Rabbi Winston, on a personal note, what are you working on currently? What's the next project?
Well, I'm just working on a book right now. I just finished a couple of translations of the Leshem, specifically because he gives the Kabbalistic background to a lot of this information. And I'm working on a book right now. It's called Taking It to a, t Taking It Even Higher, and it's about a lot of things we just spoke about right now, and explain to the people how we're supposed to look at reality, how we're supposed to function within it, how we're the opportunity to rise to higher levels of consciousness, and how that plays out in everyday life. And we're going. I'll be very happy to send you a copy of the manuscript.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we again urge all our viewers and listeners to go online and to read Rabbi Winston and to purchase all the various books that are online, and there's just tremendous amounts of wisdom and Torah, and to understand the mysteries of life and of Jewish history. Rabbi Winston, thank you so much for today. We appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.